Welcome to Drink Beer, Think Beer, a podcast that gets to the bottom of every pint. I'm John Hall. It's a bit of a departure on the show this week, as we're talking about spirits with the longtime beverage writer, Aaron Goldfarb. He has a new book out, Dusty Booze, In Search of Vintage Spirits. From where to find them, what they taste like, and who's buying, we get into it all. First, please go visit allaboutbeer.com. There you can find original articles, reviews, news, insights, and podcasts. You can listen to shows like Brewer to Brewer and the All About Beer podcast simply by searching All About Beer wherever you listen to shows. Don't forget, you can follow All About Beer on Instagram, Threads, X, and Facebook at All About Beer. And to keep up with all of the smoked beer news and releases, check out This Week in Rauch Beer by searching the group on Facebook or following at TW Rauch Beer on X, Threads, and Instagram. We also have some apparel that's available too on allaboutbeer.com/merch. This show and all of the work we do, it's supported by you. Please go visit patreon.com/allaboutbeer. A few bucks goes a long way to fund writers, photographers, creators, and editors. And if you'd like to learn more about advertising on this show, please email info@allaboutbeer.com. Beer might have its old money tickers, but it hardly compares to the finds vintage booze hunters unearth. In his latest book, Dusty Booze, In Search of Vintage Spirits, which is now available wherever fine books are sold, author Aaron Goldfarb takes us on a fascinating journey of history, intrigue, lost flavors, and today's tastes. Goldfarb, if you don't know, has been a journalist for over a decade, frequently writing on the subjects of cocktails and drinking culture for such publications as the New York Times, Esquire, Playboy, Punch, and Vine Pair. And he's had features written about his career in the Times, Forbes, and Boston Globe. His previous books include Hacking Whiskey, and he was named a finalist for the Tales of the Cocktail Spirited Awards Best New Book and Gather Around Cocktails. In 2020, Tales of the Cocktail named Goldfarb the best cocktail and spirit writer for the year. He lives in Brooklyn with his wife, daughter, son, cat, and a lot of bottles of booze. Here's our conversation. Welcome to the show. Thanks for doing this, Aaron. And you, I'm sure that a lot of folks who listen who are not writers are going to think that it's fairly commonplace, but you did with this book, or this book came from a place that I think a lot of journalists and writers often dream about. You wrote a newspaper article and got a book out of it. And I'm wondering where the genesis of that first article came from. And then did you always have a sneaking suspicion that it could be a full book?
Yeah. So Dusty Spirits, Vintage Spirits is something that's kind of fascinated me over the last decade. And I've written little articles about it for, you know, little publications that are not the New York Times. I don't know if I'd become the go-to guy to write about vintage spirits. Just not a lot of other people were actually writing about it, and it interested me in a way it didn't interest a lot of writers, which I find is a lot of my stories. I am just interested in weirder things. And even from years back, I thought, wow, if someone really had the knowledge and put in the time and effort, I think a vintage spirits book could be an incredible both reference and something to read. But I didn't think I had the ability and knowledge several years ago. Yeah. And I'm not sure, you know, like most writers, I was a little lazy and I knew it'd be a Herculean task. So I was trying to talk myself out of having to work. So then early in 2020, this guy reaches out to me on Instagram, Kevin Langdon Ackerman. He goes by the Debonair Bourbonair. And you know,
that's why I'm Debonair Bourbonair 12, because the 10 others got in front of me.
So I get, you know, I guess that decade of writing kind of these little dusty bourbon stories, vintage bourbon stories, had kind of made me the one person to go to when there was finally a massive vintage bourbon story. And that story was that he had got a tip that the legendary Hollywood director Cecil B. DeMille's booze collection from, you know, post-prohibition 30s and 40s had been uncovered in north of Los Angeles. And he, you know, pushed his breakfast aside, got in his car and sped, you know, 30 miles north of Los Angeles to, you know, this town where millionaires of the past and maybe the present live. And he, you know, this a new owner had acquired the property and didn't want all this old bourbon and rum in his basement and
this stuff mucking about. Yeah.
Yeah. Dusty bottles. And you know, Kevin cleared him out for a fair price, I'm sure. And I wrote that story for the New York Times. I had coincidentally acquired, that was my first and so far only New York Times story. I'd acquired a kind of relationship with a New York Times editor early on in the pandemic based on another story that ultimately didn't get published. So when I had this one, I knew this was a slam dunk New York Times story, and it ultimately did end up being one. And yeah, you're right. I've written a lot of books and I've written a ton of articles, and never after you write an article do the publishers come calling and want you to expand it, which did happen this time. I mean, the Cecil B. DeMille article did well, but it didn't go like ultra viral by any stretch of the imagination.
Sure, because it is still sort of a niche. Like, I remember reading it at the time and being like, damn, that's a great story. And like, I'm glad that you documented it. And then you know, you move on with your day kind of thing. Or, you know, it's one of those stories that, you know, writers will mention, you know, years later where it's like, boy, you know, you really crushed that. Or, you know, that still lives in my head a little bit, like things like that. But
Yeah. Absolutely. But, you know, several publishers did indeed think it was a story. And yet again, I went back to 5 years ago thinking, damn, I really don't want to do all this work, you know, write a 400-page book. But then Kevin told me, you think Cecil B. DeMille is big? I'm tracking an even bigger Hollywood stars collection because he lives in Los Angeles and he's also a memorabilia collector. So he kind of deals in both worlds.
Yeah.
He kind of gave me permission hesitantly to both follow along as he tried to find this other collection. I can say it. It's Howard Hughes's collection.
Okay.
That apparently had been locked in his office in 1976 after he died and apparently was still sitting there as recently as, you know, 2021, just sealed in Howard Hughes's office, which hadn't been touched by the new owners of the building that was called 7000 Romaine in Los Angeles, a fairly famous office building. And so with that as a kind of a backbone, I felt a little more confident in producing a work. And, you know, then like journalists, I started digging in. I started going places I'd never really researched before. Is there vintage tequila? Yes. Is there vintage rum? Of course. And that kind of filled out the book. So I was learning and teaching myself stuff and meeting new characters as I traveled along in the journey of writing the book, which was both great fun and a lot of work, as I said.
So let's track it back before that original article and, you know, to some of the smaller ones where, you know, all of this sort of started. What was your introduction to vintage booze, to dusty bottles?
Yeah, as you know, I kind of started more in craft beer with my writing, and I started not moving, but at the same time getting into bourbon as bourbon was having its own renaissance in the aughts. And I remember I was in Kentucky with some other writers for an event or something. This was about maybe 2012. And this guy who clearly knew a lot more than me at the time, and probably still today, Josh Peters is his name. He told me he was a dusty hunter and he'd drive around Los Angeles to old liquor stores, seedy liquor stores, stores in, you know, neighborhoods you're not supposed to go in, and sometimes find bottles that were still on the shelves from the 40s, 50s, 60s, you name it. Cause a lot of liquor bottles have barely changed their logos. You see an old granddad from the 1960s. It looks pretty much the same as today.
Yeah.
Ditto Maker's Mark, Jack Daniels, a lot of them, they really look the same. So you know, if you really didn't pay attention to your inventory, if you kind of had the customer base not really caring about the hottest and newest thing, it was possible. And this occurred in thousands of liquor stores across America, if not the world, that incredible bottles from the past were just sitting on shelves with the, you know, $2 sticker from 1965 still on them. I asked Josh, well, you know, why would I care about a 1960 old granddad? You know, yeah. what's the difference? Unlike say beer or wine, alcohol doesn't age in the bottle. So if you open a 1965 old granddad, you're going to taste what it tasted like in 1965. Again, why does that matter?
Yeah.
Well, there were different production methods in the past. There were different distilleries in the past. Old granddad for the last 30 or 40 years has been made by Jim Beam. But previous to 1987, I think, it was made by a distillery called National Distillers, one of the most legendary distilleries in American history. That's been defunct, you know, for 40 years. So to find an old granddad pre-1987 is to taste a distillery as it would have tasted then that no longer exists and is, in many people's opinion, including my own, superior to the Jim Beam distillate of today, which I happen to think is pretty decent, but doesn't compare to the National Distillers. Same with Stitzel Weller. Stitzel Weller was the distillery owned by the literal man, Pappy Van Winkle, which was producing a very unusual weeded bourbon from, I think, 1935 till 1992. You find a Stitzel Weller bottle from that era, you're going to taste something that simply doesn't exist these days. Mm. And that was very exciting to me. So a lot of my earliest stories were kind of the, you know, we've all done it as journalists, the aw shucks, this community exists and here's how you can maybe be a part of it. And here's how to read a bottle to know it's from 1982 and not 1985 and, you know, kind of reference guide type things. But for most of the world, most of the readers of these websites and publications, they didn't know this kind of stuff. And most people that read my book probably still don't know this stuff. It is a very esoteric, still fairly small community.
Yeah. And I mean, I imagine that when somebody starts writing about it, or now that a book comes out, it becomes like harder to even get into it if somebody was really looking to do it, right?
Well, the funny thing is when you know, Josh told me about Dusty Hunting back in 2012 or whatever, I kind of said to myself, ah, damn, I wish I'd heard about this earlier. It sounds like a fun thing to do. The game is already over. You know, if I started Dusty Hunting, you know, New York City in 2012, I probably would have done pretty well. But I didn't. But yeah, you know, with anything in these niche communities, there's the fear that once you publicize it, you're ruining their little community. You're getting these kind of neophytes all of a sudden walking around asking, oh, do you have any, you know, National Distillers old granddad in the back? You know, you're
right.
You're
starting to ask the clerks, then all of a sudden the game is over. Yeah.
Right. You're alerting them that $2 bottle they've been trying to sell for 50 years is actually a $500 bottle or a $1,000 bottle. I'm not sure that has happened. You know, by now, so many stories have been written. Again, I'm sorry, many by me, that if a clerk does have an old bottle, they can quickly Google it and maybe figure some things out. But incredible scores are happening all the time, just like that Cecil B. DeMille score. So it's a lot harder to ruin hobbies, especially drinking hobbies, than people think journalists have the power to do, unfortunately.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's 1,000 threads I want to pull now, but there's something about hearing your description of, okay, you know, these bottles were coming from this distillery back then and, you know, versus where they are now. And I'm wondering when you've had the chance now and again, or talking with folks who have had the chance now and again to taste those old bottles versus what's available in the market today with those largely unchanged labels. How vast is the flavor profile? How big is the difference between the flavors of back then versus the flavors now?
Well, you know, the thing about bourbon is it's, you know, been codified into American law since 1897, how it has to be made. Has to be predominantly corn, has to be aged in new charred oak barrels, et cetera, et cetera. So with such strict regulations for, you know, over 130 years, there's not going to be as vast of difference as, say, old tequila or old rum, where it's kind of more a wild west of what you can do. And tequila, of course, is using, you know, produce, agave, which has changed rapidly over the last 40 years due to the American love affair with tequila. So I wouldn't necessarily say it's vast. If I handed you a 1960s bourbon and didn't tell you what it was, you wouldn't go, "What the hell is this? This
It
doesn't
wouldn't taste
taste."
so far outside the realm of, yeah.
Yeah, you would clearly be able to identify it as bourbon. It would probably taste better to you, richer in texture, exploding with notes of caramel and cinnamon spice and stuff like that. But you would clearly identify it as a very, very good bourbon. And to be clear, there are bourbons today that are just as good as bourbons from the past. But a lot of the stuff from the past, especially when you have what many people of today would perceive as a bottom shelf bottle, you know, an old Grandad, an old Overholt, they'd be sublime compared to, you'd have to compare them to top shelf stuff today.
Oh, that's interesting. I like that. I mean, what, when did that switch happen for us thinking about some of those bottles? Was it, is it marketing? Is it
Well,
just a proliferation of more distilleries or more brands?
yeah, I think that's it. It's kind of exploding portfolios. You know, old Grandad, I don't even know if there were top shelf, middle shelf, and bottom shelf back in 1960 because everyone just made one brand. There was old Grandad, there was Wild Turkey. You know, Wild Turkey today has Wild Turkey 80 proof and 101 proof. They have their Russell's Reserve line. They have their Master's Keep line. They have, so there's all these different levels and categories. But back then it was just everyone has their, you know, $6 bottle of bourbon, and you're an old Grandad man or an old pro man or a Jack Daniels, you know, drinker
Yeah.
or
So
whatnot.
how it
So
was in the beer space of, you know, one of the big three or big four. Yeah.
yes, exactly. Yeah. Totally right. It wasn't the ballooning portfolios, which kind of happen, you know, I guess maybe 90s or 2000s. To be clear, there were some people dipping in to the top shelf game. Stitzel Weller, which I mentioned, ran by Pappy Van Winkle. He was releasing Old Fitzgerald, which he had a very old Fitzgerald and a very, very old Fitzgerald and a very, I think, very extra old Fitzgerald. So it's kind of fitting Pappy Van Winkle today. The bottle is the, you know, hype bottle par excellence, because Pappy Van Winkle, the man, even back in the 30s and 40s, was one of the first to really get on the hype train of trying to excite drinkers with ultra age stuff, with fancy packaging, with, you know, cool labels and, you know, gold foil, whatever. But aside from that, you know, there wasn't a high-end old Grandad. There wasn't, you know, Maker's Mark famously has just made Maker's Mark from 1965 till, you know, I think 2010 or whenever, when they introduced their Maker's Mark 46. It just wasn't something you did. You made your best bourbon possible, and that was that.
Yeah. So as you start getting into this book and as you start, you know, you're talking with folks who are actively hunting, there's always that part, or usually there's that part of a book where during the reporting phase, you think it's going one way, and then all of a sudden it takes a turn. The reporting reveals something new, you know, a new thread opens up a new wormhole, whatever you want to call it, rabbit hole. Was there that for you with this book?
Yeah, you know, all I had known all the way up to selling the book were bourbon dusty hunters. You know, bourbon guys are kind of the loudest spirits collectors in America. whether you're deep into the scene or not, you know, there's, you know, just bros that love their Pappy and their Yamazaki and their, you know, whatever. So I thought it was going to be an entire book about these bourbon guys. Cause I, again, I'd never heard of anyone that collected other things. I didn't even know if they existed. But after recounting so many stories of these bourbon collectors and, you know, there's only so much you can talk about bourbon from the past, I started asking myself, are there dusty hunters for tequila? Are there vintage rum collectors? And when I started going into those other categories that I knew almost nothing of, I actually found some of my better stories in the entire book and better reasons for why someone would want to dip into the past when it comes to spirit collecting and drinking.
The tequila and the rum part, I find the most fascinating, just because, and I know you were on Steal This Beer and we talked about it a little bit, but what we think of as tequila now is such a far cry from what tequila was in the era that that you're writing about in the book. And it seems to be similar with rum as well. Is that just the victim of overproduction?
Yeah, I mean, tequila was never meant, and I can say never meant because there wasn't a grand king of tequila 200 years ago that said this is only made to be drunk by, you know, Mexicans. But when you're making something that can only come from one kind of agave from one region of the world, and agave should take 5 to 7 years to mature before they're most fit to use in tequila, this is not a product that can be in every grocery store and liquor store on planet Earth, which it mostly is today. So these big brands and the tequila industry had not been affected by conglomerates till I think 1999 was the first year a international conglomerate acquires a tequila brand. That's Brown-Forman, who owns Jack Daniels, acquired, I think, Herradura. So this was mostly a kind of untouched spirit until the 2000s. And that's when it starts getting kind of rapidly drunk and pursued by eventually first Americans and then eventually the whole globe. I mean, tequila's red hot in Europe these days. There's no way to make tequila faster. There's no way to make whiskey faster either, but you can sell 2-year-old whiskey. It's not going to taste as good as 10-year-old whiskey, but you can do it.
Yeah.
With tequila, you know, if you harvest agave in two years, it's not going to be as ripe. It's not going to have as much sugar content in it for fermentation. It's not going to ultimately taste as flavorful as good, but that's what was being done. You know, if it's not cooked in a in-ground earthen oven, it's not going to taste as good as if you, you know, rapidly cook it. You think about, you know, braising meats compared to, you know, cooking in the microwave or whatever. So all these little steps conglomerates started introducing to once great brands to speed up the process and get bottles out the door as quick as possible. Every little step made tequila worse. You know, I've talked about this with you. Not a lot of people know that you can legally add additives to tequila. You can add vanilla flavoring. You can add oak extract to make something taste more barrel aged than it is. You can add glycerin, which is a thing that adds mouthfeel. It adds a thickness and a richness. All these phony things can be added to cover up poorly harvested tequila, poorly produced tequila, and tequila that is either flavorless or not particularly good. So when a lot of people say, you know, I love Casamigos, they don't really love tequila. They love the vanilla flavoring that's covering up presumably the not so tasty tequila underneath. And then put in a Casamigos bottle and promoted by George Clooney.
I mean, I know this doesn't necessarily play into the book, but I'm sort of fascinated about this. And maybe it does play into the book, but the idea of then those properly made, properly distilled tequilas of all those years ago versus, you know, what you just described with, you know, Casamigos, right? By and large, do consume like today's consumers care? I mean, I you know, I think about, you know, how Cinco de Mayo has just become like a drinking holiday, you know, weirdly. And, you know, people are going to do shots of Cuervo because Cuervo tastes like Cuervo kind of thing, or, you know, whatever it is. And it's not necessarily a beverage that has even been marketed as like savoring, you know, like I know people get a margarita, but then that's just going to be lime juice, right? Or it's going to be, you know, something that you shoot down versus sipping. And I know that there's a niche of folks who will get tequila for sipping, that kind of thing, but it's not by and large the drinking public. So do people care, do you think, about what tequila tastes like now versus back then by and large? And then what do those collectors, if they are actually drinking any of these bottles, what are they getting out of that experience?
Well, you know, there's, unlike probably any other spirits category, tequila has like several different sects of people, you know, S-E-C-T-S.
Yeah, no, yeah.
you know, you have like the club goers that love to, you know, drink the tequila in obnoxious bottles, which is, you know, which is palatable stuff. But it's stuff that's often covered up by additives and whatnot. You know, you have the people that are just happy with their Casamigos margaritas. And then the smallest group is kind of the people that actually love to taste agave, which I do include myself in now.
Did you, before you started writing this?
You know, I drank a lot of tequila and I kind of knew what was good and bad. But there were two eye-opening experiences for me. So Salza, which is a brand still today, and, you know, not a great brand pursued by serious tequila drinkers. It was an incredible brand back in the day before all this funny business started going on. And I tried a 1960s Salza at a bar. It was $30 a pour for 2 ounces, which is pretty reasonable in the vintage game.
Maybe not so much for writers, but yeah, that's
right. And I actually,
there goes your advance. Yeah.
there's a quote in my book from this guy, Pablo Moy, who was a legendary tequila dusty hunter in the day and a bourbon dusty hunter. And he owned bars in Los Angeles and now he owns bourbon brands. But he says a quote I love, that when you taste vintage tequila, it's like the first time you've ever tasted tequila. And you really won't understand that quote until you try one of these tequilas from the past. So when I tried that 1960 Salza, I could tell that was like the first time I'd ever tasted what tequila is supposed to taste like. It tasted like the land, the earth, minerals, vegetation. It didn't taste like vanilla frosting or barrel extract or, you know, hangover in a bottle. It tasted what tequila is supposed to taste like. And again, that Salza from the 60s would have been on the same shelf with Old Granddad. It wouldn't have been a vaunted bottle of the era. You know, tequila was like 1% of the market, spirits market in America back then, I think. So when I tried that, my mind was blown. And so now you're seeing brands, modern brands today, that know there is a small base of connoisseurs, and they're trying to go back to creating tequila the old-fashioned way. Probably the most famous or hyped modern brand is called Fortaleza, and it's owned by one of the Salza's, you know, scions. And he kind of, you know, loathes the fact that, you know, his family's great name has kind of been perverted. So he is making tequila the way his forebears used to make it. And it's incredible stuff. Unfortunately, it's become also incredibly hyped and hard to find these days.
I was going to say, yeah.
But that's the one, if you taste it, especially the Blanco or the still strength Blanco, which just comes off the still and is bottled. That's what, for the most part, vintage tequila would taste like. And it's not a flavor profile you really see in a lot of tequilas, certainly not a lot of mainstream tequilas you're going to see at, you know, sports bars or whatnot today. There's a few other brands that are making good stuff too. Cimbre, Valis, Lalo. There's certainly a few, and more every day are trying to get into this just artisan tequila making that's kind of been lost to conglomerates and nightclub culture and whatnot. But I'm pretty optimistic about where tequila is headed for the most part.
Does it, having had that bottle from the 60s, and having been drinking tequila beforehand, I'm wondering, does it change the way that you, as a casual drinker, even if you could be a casual drinker, I know it's tough when we're in these jobs, to I don't mean like it's, it's tough to drink casually. I just mean like we approach our things with a critical palate or a critical eye a lot of the time. Has tequila fundamentally changed for you? Like when you have tequila for quote unquote the first time from one of these bottles, can you go backwards?
No, I mean, most Americans were of about the same age, I think. Tequila was pretty much a bad word when we grew up. It's what you drank in a frat house basement. It's what you drank as punishment. It was not a
It's bad
luxury.
decisions.
And the tequila today is now, still somewhat seen as a party drink and whatnot. As you said, it not a sippable spirit in most people's eyes. When you taste stuff from the past, or when you taste Fortaleza in the present, you're really tasting something that completely changes your opinion of what tequila can be and what it should be.
There's a couple of bars around the country that we've talked about that specialize in vintage cocktails or vintage drinks for those of us who, don't have access to old Hollywood royalty bottles or whatever. What have you found for the curious who are out there? What do you recommend is a good introduction to being able to taste some of these? Be it in a cocktail, be it in a, is it just, hey, what do you like now? And go find something from the past and get a pour of it? Is it get out of your comfort zone a little bit? What's a good way to experience some of these bottles?
If you drink some of that Stitzel Weller from the 60s, that's going to run you hundreds and hundreds of dollars an ounce. So not the greatest place to start. But I usually recommend stuff from Heaven Hill prior to 1996. Heaven Hill's still making great stuff these days, but in 1996, the entire Heaven Hill campus caught on fire. And a lot of barrels burned down and distilling equipment. So that's kind of a demarcation line between the past and the present. As I said, Heaven Hill's still very good these days, but if you taste 80s, 1980s Heaven Hill, which won't cost you a ton of money for now, it just has a richness and mouthfeel. And even at a lower proof, 80 proof, 85 proof, it's just a lot better than what you would expect from 85 proof these days. Most, bourbon nuts these days will only drink high proof stuff. And that's not completely because they're, trying to flex how tough they are. I get it. 80 proof bourbon, modern bourbon to me is almost undrinkable. It's so watery and so lacking in flavor. You try that 80 proof Heaven Hill from the 1980s, and it's packed with flavor, packed with texture and mouthfeel, and you're saying what went wrong in these intervening years to make 80 proof bourbon so undrinkable?
Is that a stance? Sorry to interrupt, but is that a stance that you had even before writing the book, or is that also something that has emerged through your research and tasting for
Well,
you personally?
I'd always found modern low proof stuff virtually undrinkable and lacking in flavor. I don't necessarily think you need to go to what the collectors call hazmat bourbon. That's 140 proof or higher, so-called because it's not allowed on airplanes because it could catch fire. But Yeah, you know, Basil Hayden's probably the most famous 80 proof bourbon these days, and you know, it's like iced tea to me and a lot of drinkers. So I knew I didn't like low proof stuff these days, but when I tried it from the past, because there wasn't high proof stuff in the past, there was, you know, 100 proof might be a very high proof in the past. Wild Turkey famously had their 101. That was kind of the max cap for proof back then, maybe 107 for a few Stitzel Wellers, but there were not 130 proof bourbons in the 60s, as far as I know. And they were just able to pack a lot more flavor into that proof back in the day.
I've been thinking about as I was reading through the book, an experience that I had. It was probably post college at this point, but we were at a house in the Poconos that my mother-in-law owns, and we were going through the old closets as you do when we were having a party, and we found an old bottle of Virginia Gentleman
Yeah.
bourbon that was still sealed, had the tax stamp on it. The white label across the top and everything. And realizing that it hadn't been touched probably since they moved in the 80s, we're like, well, nobody's gonna miss this. So we opened it and we had a great time. I don't remember a damn thing about how it tasted. I remember the hangover the next day. But in reading the book, it occurs to me that as, it's not just necessarily great booze collections of famous Hollywood scions, but that there probably are folks who have bottles in their houses, or their parents' houses or their grandparents' houses, that maybe was given as a gift all those years ago. Maybe it's moved around from time to time. Is there an amount, or is there dusty booze in, like, hiding in plain sight in somebody's home liquor cabinet? Or
Yeah.
maybe not so much.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of collectors have realized that the days of going to, you know, retail stores and finding these old bottles, those have all been pretty much picked over. The new collections are coming from houses. You know, old people are dying every single day. Sorry to break it to you.
It happens, yeah.
And, you know, a lot of them had collections they didn't finish. Some have gifts. I'm in the last week, I've learned, maybe it's a positive, maybe it's a negative of having written this book. I'm getting a lot of DMs on Instagram from strangers saying, "I have this bottle. I found this bottle. Grandma has this bottle. What's it worth?"
Yeah.
And
I was
nine
going to say,
times.
because everybody wants to play Antiques Roadshow with this now.
Yeah. So just yesterday, I had three of those DMs, and two of them I had to tell them, well, you know, it's kind of crap. You're not gonna get rich. And then one woman wrote me, and she happened to have a probably $5,000 bottle of old Stitzel Weller,
Damn.
and I said, congratulations. You know, that's a great bottle. You can drink it, or I'm happy to take it off your hands for a very, very bad price. but
There goes the next book advance. Yeah.
yeah, I mean, one of the things is a lot of people from the past, a lot of, you know, our grandparents drank stuff that's not particularly sexy to collectors today, whether Canadian whiskey, blended scotch,
Yeah.
you know, weird liqueurs like Midori. That's all my grandpa had in his cabinet when he died, and I tried to raid it. And those might be better tasting than their incarnations today, but they don't have much value. If grandma dies in Louisville, though, there's a decent chance her basement might have something good in it.
What about today's bottles? Is there, because I imagine at this point, right, somebody reads this book and says, okay, well, what if I go and get, tequila from today, or
Yeah.
I get rum from today, even after you've explained what these taste like, how these are made. And I'm going to put them down in the basement, and then 60 years from now, when my grandkids find them, this is gonna, help them buy their first condo on the moon, like whatever the fuck it is. Like, is there a market for stashing stuff away now?
I mean, I'd probably say it's a better game plan to just buy some crypto with a weird name, but You know, we never know what's going to be worth money in the future. I mean,
Right.
I've recounted this story before, and it's in the book. It still blows my mind that in 1987, Jim Beam paid, I think, $550 million to National Distillers, which I've mentioned before,
Yeah.
to take peach schnapps off their hands because peach schnapps was the hottest thing in 1987. And tossed in on that deal was Old Granddad, Old Crow, Old Taylor, and Old Overholt, which no one on planet Earth was drinking in 1987. Well, you know, that's like trading for this shortstop you think's great, and they, you know, throw in Cal Ripken as an extra and think he's a bum.
Right.
They made an incredible deal, and they just didn't know why they made an incredible deal. So who the hell knows what people are going to drink in 20 years? Bourbon might be headed towards another, you know, a glut. No one might care about bourbon in 20 years, and we might be kicking ourselves for not having acquired more, you know, more of those fireballs at the register at 7-Eleven. Maybe those will be worth a lot of money.
The plastic bottles.
Malt-based fireball.
I wanted to ask as well, just to sort of go back to the beginning as well. Is there a reason that Los Angeles or California was such a hotbed or features so prominently in this story?
I've asked myself that so many times, and I don't know whether it's because it's the biggest state with the most major cities and the most expanses and probably the most miles of road to drive on, and the most, you know, we could dare say the most kooks to that would want to actually spend all day driving around looking for, you know, weird tequilas from the past. I don't know. I've asked myself that question, why I meet so many dusty hunters, both in bourbon and tequila and even other things that are based in California. I really don't know the answer, besides that it's the biggest state with all those reasons I mentioned. I really don't know.
Yeah. In the acknowledgments of your book, you dedicate it to the memory of Randy Baker, who you say was your favorite high school English teacher.
Oh, wow.
Can
Yeah.
you tell me about Randy Baker?
That's a deep cut from the book. Wow. Okay.
Yeah,
I didn't
read
think
the
anyone's going to read
you
that.
know, everybody should read the acknowledgments.
Check to check if they made
Well,
it.
clearly, yeah. I knew I
Yeah.
wasn't going to be in this one, but yeah.
Even
No,
though you.
I like it when people reference teachers, and
Yeah.
especially teachers that had a formidable impact on a writer's career.
Yeah, he was I guess he was my AP English teacher. Was he junior year or senior year? I can't remember. It's probably junior year because no one pays attention senior year. No, a lot of people disliked him. He was kind of an odd man with a dark sense of humor. He loved to loudly read Canterbury Tales, especially the most bawdy tales like The Wife of Bath Tale. I'll let people Google that themselves.
Yeah, this is, I mean, like we let a lot of things go on this show. I'm not gonna, yeah.
Yeah. You know, he was just kind of one of those people that seemed too smart, and I'm not trying to be offensive here, to just to be teaching high school English. He
Right. Be
taught
hanging out
like
with, yeah, trying to
he taught like a
16-year-olds, yeah.
professor. Yeah, he taught like a professor, and he pushed people to do things. And as I said, a lot of people disliked him because he was odd and demanding and offbeat. But I just thought he was the funniest, brightest guy, and yeah, he died of brain cancer while I was writing the acknowledgement. So that's a great way to get in him.
Yeah, it's I feel like there are these teachers that a lot of writers have along the way that if we recognize them in the moment or not, are often sitting on our shoulders while we're writing. If it's, you know, our eagerness to, you know, please them or make them happy or, you know,
Yeah.
to justify the time that they spent on us.
Yeah, I'm not sure I spoke to him since, you know, I was 18 years old either. And I'm 45 now, so
Yeah.
think about that.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you the Green Door question,
Okay.
which is the premise on the show is in the television show The Good Place in the final season, they introduce a concept of a green door where the characters can walk through it and be anywhere they want, doing whatever they want to be doing. And this is the beer-centric show, so I'm going to ask you the beer question. But if we had a green door on our plane of existence and this conversation ended and you could walk through it and be at any pub or any brewery anywhere in the world, where would you want to go? Who would you want to be with? And what would you like to be drinking?
Oh, wow. Breweries accepted or just pubs?
Yeah.
Let me think about that. I was thinking about Cantillon because I just had a wonderful experience there, probably circa 2012. I don't know if it's as sweet now as it was then, but you know, it wasn't overloaded with Americans just crushing Fufun bottles. It was, you could have a relaxing Saturday while what Jean-Pierre put logs on the fire and people just pleasantly drink. But I think I'm gonna pick Mache in Rome. Have you been there, John?
I have not.
It's got a longer name that I always forget. That's like 10 words and means something in Italian, but you can call it Mache, MA/CHEA. It's this minuscule bar. There's always old Italians just smoking cigarettes and watching like Division IV soccer, but it has the most unbelievable beer list, but no one goes there because it has the most unbelievable beer list. People go there to drink and have community, but then one American walks by and goes, holy cow, they have like St. Lambinus on tap. Why is that on tap? And then you come back the next day and that tap's been tapped and they have another Cantillon on tap. And you're going, what is going on here? I haven't seen a single beer geek who is crushing all this beer. And they have the best, you know, lagers and pilsners. And it's just an incredible list. But again, you don't go there because they have incredible stuff. You go there to get a beer and then you take it outside and stand on the cobblestone streets while Vespas shoot by and nearly kill you, and you enjoy the Rome air. You know, I liked it because, you know, my kids and my wife and my family we could just be outside hanging in Rome, and I could walk back in and get another beer and just enjoy the beautiful Rome atmosphere. So I'd pick my family at Mache.
I love that. That's great. There's so much more to uncover about Dusty Booze, Vintage Booze. So I'm going to encourage everybody to go and get the book, which as of this airing is now available where all books are sold. And you should go and support it. It's called Dusty Booze in Search of Vintage Spirits. And it's by the one and only Aaron Goldfarb. Thanks for being on the show this week. Thanks for writing this book. This is a fun book.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm glad I did write it.
Any fun bottles tucked away in your cabinets? Tell me about it. You can email me. It's John Hall. That's JohnHoll at allaboutbeer.com. That's also how you can get in touch with questions, comments, or guest suggestions. A reminder, go visit allaboutbeer.com. There you can check out the podcast page, the merch page, and read great new content, as well as the archives going back to 1979. Don't forget, you can follow All About Beer on social media at All About Beer. And if you're interested in supporting journalism in the beer space, and I hope you are, you can email us at info@allaboutbeer.com or go to patreon.com/allaboutbeer. One more time, don't forget, All About Beer is a podcast channel. Search and subscribe on your podcast platform of choice. Steal This Beer has new episodes every Monday. The BYO Nano podcast comes out on the 15th of every month. And go check out probrewer.com each week for original articles from the All About Beer team. As for this show, Nate Schweber does the music, Jeff Quinn designed our logo, and I'm John Hall. New episodes release every Wednesday, and that's when I'll be back again to drink beer and to think beer.